Everything Jesus did revolved around prioritizing that core relationship above all others. After the Father, the Gospels indicate that Jesus' closest relationships were with the 12 disciples. These were the people he partnered with, traveled with, taught, trained, and trusted. Within that group, he was especially close to Peter, James, and John. They were privileged to share incredible revelations, encounters, and conversations with Jesus that no one else did. And of those three, we know that John was the one Jesus loved, the one he charged with taking over his role as Mary's son. The 12, the 3, and the 1. This is the picture Jesus gave us of how many relationships we have the capacity to cultivate and how to prioritize them according to the levels of intimacy. I created a diagram to illustrate the levels of intimacy we need to cultivate and protect with boundaries. The innermost circle is your core. Some people like to call this the God spot, because he's the only person who belongs in the core of your heart and spirit. Nobody else knows you and loves you like Jesus. Nobody else deserves your heart's primary allegiance and worship, and nobody should hold the place of influence he holds in your life. The next circle out of intimacy is for your most intimate human relationships, your deepest soul tie. Only one person is going to fit into that spot. If you are married, this should be your spouse. If you are unmarried, this person could be a friend, a parent, a sibling, or even a business partner. When you do get married, you'll face a delicate transition as you move the person who has been on that level back a circle or two and let your spouse take his or her place. This might be uncomfortable, but it must be done. Sometimes people hurt or scare us. If that happens, we must move them out to a place of access they can handle. Often, people who held the most intimate place in our lives find themselves outside in the Al-Qaeda sphere. The size of the mess that they have to clean up is beyond their willingness to fix. We keep our love on toward them, but it may be a very long time before we ever have them over for dinner. Maybe you are divorced or widowed and have decided to put your children in that most intimate level. If you remarry and say, "I just want you to know that my children will always be the most important thing to me," then you are effectively putting your spouse in submission to your children. This will not work out very well. Again, only one person deserves that most intimate place in your life. The further out we go in the circles of intimacy, the more people we can fit in them. The next circle contains people like your kids and grandkids, followed by your closest friends. Heading out further, you have good friends, then coworkers, and then acquaintances. Keep going out and you find the people in the same geographic location, and finally the rest of the human race. Yes, you are called to love all people, but that doesn't mean that all people have the same access to your core. You may be called to pray for someone in Hollywood like Charlie Sheen or a group of people that feel scary like Al-Qaeda. Even though your response may be to pray for them, it doesn't mean that you will allow them into your core circle. It's your job to manage your life so that you can offer the people in your innermost circles appropriate access to your core. Boundaries around levels of intimacy. The level of intimacy a person has in my life determines how much of myself I will offer them when they pull on the relationship. If I am chatting with someone from church for the first time and they tell me the engine in their car blew up, I am probably going to give my sympathies and offer to pray with them for provision. If I've interacted with them a few times and know them a little, I will probably say, "Oh, I'm so sorry. Here's the number to my mechanic." If one of my good friends come to me with the woes of an exploded engine, I may toss them the keys and say, "Here, borrow my car until you get your car fixed. Take your time." If my daughter or one of my sons comes to me and says, "Dad, my engine just blew up," I'll pull out my checkbook and cover the repairs. And finally, if Sherry comes to me, there's no doubt in my mind that I am talking with the person who will be picking out the color of my next car. Because she is my most intimate relationship, I am willing to put all of my time, money, energy, and resources toward helping her with her problem. After Jesus, she's my greatest priority and has greatest access to my life. As a Christian minister, I have hundreds of people going in and out of the outer circles of my life. I have never had a conversation with most of them, but because I have influence in their life in some way, they feel like they have a connection with me. I've had countless people walk up and say, "Hey, remember me? I think to myself, no, but I smile and talk with them for a few minutes. I don't put up a boundary that says, don't talk to me unless you know me personally. But I also don't pretend that I can be something for that person I will never be. I love lots of people through my ministry. I counsel them, pray with them, laugh with them, and cry with them. But that's it. They don't get the bulk of my time, attention, or money. They don't get to know my heart and influence my decisions. After our few hours together, I leave those people at church and go home to my family and close friends. It often surprises people when they find out that my name, address, and phone number are all in the phone book. Many people have advised me to change this, but I'm okay with it because every one of these technological devices we call phones have incredible features called caller ID and voicemail. If you call me and your last name isn't Silk or Serple, my married daughter's last name, you will most likely go to a voicemail. I will decide upon hearing your voice whether to respond to you right now or wait until later. You will never be responsible to manage my time at home. That is my job. I give people a level of access to me by having my number in the phone book, but I have a boundary that I am under no obligation to answer or even call you back. I didn't set this boundary either to offend or please you. I did it to manage my priorities at my house. Do people ever try to demand more from me than I've decided to offer at their level of intimacy? Sure. This is where I have to honor my boundaries and make sure that I do not start treating someone on the outer circle like I treat one of my kids. As soon as I do, I am threatening my relationship with my kids because they're the ones who rightfully belong at that level. Although I genuinely care about people's needs, I know that I have limited resources with which to actually meet them, and I have committed those resources to my closest relationships. If I start pulling out of my son's account to meet the needs of a stranger, or out of my wife's account to meet the needs of my kids, I am violating the priority of my core connections. Of course, because I've now invested consistently in my closest relationships for decades, it's pretty easy to honor the boundaries I've set around them. As their value has increased in my life, other things have become less and less capable of competing with that value. I don't feel remotely pressured to hand over my checkbook when an acquaintance comes to me with a car problem. I don't struggle with guilt over ignoring a phone call when I'm spending time with my wife. This is how boundaries work. You say yes to something, which necessarily means saying no to everything else. At first, it may be a challenge to hold on to your yes, as all the things you said no to present themselves and say, really? Why not? But if you consistently set a firm boundary around your yes, eventually the things you said no to don't present themselves as viable options. It becomes a lifestyle to live within your boundaries. You'll be glad to know that Bob and Linda rescued their family from ministry burnout and began incorporating boundaries to protect their yes to their family before other people. Bob stopped working for free and started paying off his debt. Linda stopped sewing during her free time and now makes it to games, recitals, and a weekly date night with Bob. These changes have transformed the dynamic of their family. The kids feel loved, safe, and prioritized, and so do Bob and Linda. Yes, people were upset with them for communicating that they had other priorities. Bob and Linda endured accusations that they were not very good friends. But by now, they don't really care. Bob still helps out a friend every now and then, and Linda has volunteered to do a few alterations, but all in moderation. No longer consistently drained, they can actually minister to the hurting and needy. Their time with the Lord, their connection to each other, and their connection with their children has translated to a peaceful, connected, intentional lifestyle that they do not plan to change anytime soon. Jesus set boundaries. Some people mistakenly think Jesus is like them, a whacked-out, codependent person at the mercy of everybody's needs. If we truly want to live the Christian life Jesus modeled, then we have to pay attention to the fact that he regularly set boundaries with needy people. For example, Luke 8 records a story of Jesus raising Jairus' daughter from the dead. When the story begins, Jesus has just encountered a whole crowd of people who have been waiting a long time and desperately needing something from him. They know he has the resources and ability to meet their needs, and he has a track record of meeting people's needs. Somehow, Jairus makes it to the front of the crowd and asks Jesus to come heal his little girl. And Jesus makes a decision. He says yes. That yes in that moment was also a no to a bunch of other people who all needed healing too. Really? Jesus actually said no to a bunch of desperately needy people? You bet he did. It's right there in the Bible. Yes, we know that Jesus healed all who came to him on many occasions. But in every case, it was because of his choice. This fact is particularly highlighted in the story of blind Bartimaeus. When he hears that Jesus is walking past him, Bartimaeus starts yelling, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." The disciples get irritated and tell him to be quiet, but he just gets louder. "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus turns to Bart and asks, "What is it that you want?" I can imagine Bart wasn't sure about this question. He was probably wondering, "Isn't it obvious? Is Jesus blind too?" "My sight." Jesus says, "Okay, here you go." Bartimaeus asks, and Jesus responds with an answer, "Yes." But Jesus' yes wasn't driven by Bartimaeus' need. Ultimately, Jesus said yes to every person he healed, and no at times to other people. Though, of course, this no was not necessarily a permanent no, but a not now. Because he had dedicated his life to one big yes. And that was to live out the complete oneness and partnership with his Father, to do what his Father was doing, say what his Father was saying, and be about his business. The big yes. Jesus modeled the big yes that is to define our lives. I know for a fact that I would never have been able to make the boundaries I've set around the relationships in my life if I have not said yes to the primary relationship with Jesus. If you don't prioritize your relationship with God, then your God spot will end up with a human being in it. That, my friend, is idolatry. Many a powerless person has allowed their spouse or someone else to scoot into that spot, and it puts their priorities, their resources, and their relationships out of whack. Their boundaries disappear. Soon, their kids are in control of their life, their marriage is falling apart, and before they know it, they're trying to escape it all by having an affair or taking up some ridiculous hobby or addiction. They end up as powerless, scared, and manipulative people who exploit relationships in order to survive them. Conversely, putting God first in our lives won't compete with our human relationships. It will protect them because one of God's top priority in his relationship with us is teaching us how to love the people he's put in our lives. Keeping God in your God spot keeps you connected to the Holy Spirit's incredible resources of wisdom and understanding to define your relational priorities and boundaries. He's going to show you who you're supposed to be, with who you're supposed to be connecting, and how to build and protect those connections. He's also the Spirit of power, love, and self-control who enables you to follow through on your yes to these relationships. Will there be challenges to keep God in your God spot and holding on to your big yes? Will there be things that try to compete with our value for him, tempt us to violate our boundaries, and give away to others what only he deserves? Absolutely. The enemy wants to use these tests to distract us and ruin our lives, but God will use these tests to make us powerful. Likewise, it is powerful when you choose God above all other options, circumstances, feelings, and desires, especially when this choice is uncomfortable. Through the gospel, God has made one thing abundantly clear. The big yes he asks of us is only what he has already given us. He has created us with a God spot because he has given us access to the deepest spot in his heart. He has placed the highest value on us, and his priority is nothing less than giving us all that he is. Saying yes to him means saying yes to experiencing the incredible reality of his love for us. And the more we do experience it, the easier it gets to live within the boundaries that keep him as a priority in our lives and protect the priority he defines for our relationships. Chapter 9. Guidelines for Setting Limits. A few years ago, Suburban Auto Group came out with those hilarious Trunk Monkey commercials. A man is sitting in his car. He just made a mistake of honking at a truck driven by a huge, scary-looking guy. The scary guy has parked his truck, gotten out, and is banging on the honker's window, roaring insults and threats. Terrified, the man in the car grips his steering wheel, staring straight ahead, trying to ignore the thug until he goes away. Then he finds a piece of paper and plasters it against the window in an attempt to block out the bad guy. Finally, he remembers. He has a trunk monkey button. He pushes it, the trunk pops open. Out jumps the trunk monkey, wielding a crowbar and knocks out the scary trucker. The monkey high-fives the man in the car and jumps back in the trunk. The first time I saw this commercial, I laughed hysterically. Who hasn't at one time or another wished they had something like a trunk monkey? How great would it be to push a button and have someone else handle all the upset, hurt, scary, needy people who try to pressure, intimidate, and manipulate you? Alas, trunk monkeys only exist in commercials. But for some reason, I still happen to encounter a lot of people who seem to believe that one day, a trunk monkey button is magically going to appear on the dashboard of their car. Instead of acting like powerful people and setting limits in their relationships, they continue to sit there, waiting for their problems to go away and letting other people roll over them. This is how people end up in that destructive triangulation dynamic I describe in Chapter 1. The commercial portrays triangulation brilliantly. You have three players. The powerless victim sitting in his car, the scary bad guy trying to intimidate the victim into compliance, and the monkey rescuer leaping to defend the victim. It's a perfect circle of control. The bad guy controls the victim controls the rescuer, and the rescuer controls the bad guy. But who wins in the end? The bad guy who is knocked out unconscious? The monkey rescuer who goes back to live in the trunk until called for? Or the victim who drives away traumatized and not one bit more powerful or safe than he was before he unleashed the rescuer? No one wins when you choose to be powerless against your problems. You only create more problems. In real life, unleashing a monkey who hits people with a crowbar is going to land you in a lawsuit. You destroy your relationships when you refuse to take responsibility, confront issues, and set limits. We must all accept the reality that the world we live in is filled with genuinely scary things and people who are hazardous to our health and relationships. Our longtime mortal enemies, the world, the flesh, and the devil, continue to wage their campaign to destroy our connections with God and one another. Not one of us will pass through life without encountering their threats and attacks. However, that war has already been won. Sin and death, the barriers to our connection with God, are defeated. Nothing can turn off God's love for us or separate us from it. God's purpose in allowing us to face our enemies is to give us opportunities to rise up as true sons and daughters, capable of making powerful choices to turn our love on and keep it on no matter what. Nothing less than our eternal destiny is at stake as we learn to fight for our connections, manage our levels of intimacy, and set healthy boundaries around our lives and relationships. So let's give up the powerless search for trunk monkeys and start going after the exhilarating journey of learning to set our own limits and confront our own problems. Taking care of yourself. Your life is a gift from God to you. It has infinite value to Him, which He communicates to you in all the many ways He loves you. God is always sending you love messages. If you feel that He does not love you, odds are you have stopped opening your mail. I spoke with a young man recently. He told me he felt that he did not feel God's presence anymore. I asked him if he had recently been offended. "Well, yeah," he answered. "At my old church, I got really hurt." "Okay," I said. "Here's what I suggest. Clean up your forgiveness. That is most likely the key factor in why you're not feeling love. He hasn't changed. You have." The young man dealt with his bitterness, and what do you know? He was able to reconnect with God's presence and feel His love again. Do whatever you need to do so you can receive His love for you. Take care of yourself. The more you receive His love, the more you will learn to value your life as He does. The process of receiving God's value for your life is what anchors you in setting healthy boundaries. Powerlessness, irresponsibility, and lack of boundaries are all rooted in failing to value your life as you should. Conversely, honoring God's value for your life will lead you to be responsible for protecting it and cultivating it. After God created the world, He planted a garden and put Adam in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. This is a picture of each of our lives. God has given all of us a garden to tend. He plants trees in it and sends the sun and rain to make them grow. But we are the ones who have the responsibility to care for the trees and the right to enjoy their fruit. No one else has that responsibility. Only by being diligent in managing what is ours will we reap a harvest that will nourish us and give us something good to offer others. Healthy relationships grow between people who have embraced their individual responsibility to tend their own gardens. Yes, both come to the relationship with needs and participate in meeting one another's needs. But it is a simple economic principle that each of them must be healthy and fruitful in order to continue offering resources to one another to meet each other's needs. You have to take care of yourself before you can take care of someone else. If you've ever been on a plane, you have been subjected to the flight attendant spiel about what to do if the cabin loses pressure. They explain that oxygen masks will fall from the ceiling and show you how to put them on. Every time, they remind you that if you're traveling with a child or someone else in need of assistance, you must be sure to put your mask on before you try to help anyone else. The implication is clear. If you don't take care of yourself, then you won't be able to care for anyone else. You'll be lying unconscious in the aisle. The lesson of the oxygen mask exposes the flawed thinking many people have about what it means to serve and love others. For some reason, people think that taking care of yourself means being selfish. Yes, it's true that you can cultivate your garden and then choose to keep all your fruit to yourself. I know people who wrongly use boundaries to be independent and withhold their lives from others instead of using them to protect their ability to sustain fruitfulness, generosity, and the exchange of life in covenant relationships. Self-protection is not a good motivation for taking care of yourself and will create problems in your relationships. But you will create just as many problems if you don't tend your garden. You're going to have to get food from somewhere, and it will be someone else's food. Not taking care of yourself actually puts you in the powerless position of trying to get other people to meet your needs without being able to offer anything in return. This is a setup for an unhealthy, selfish relationship. If you truly want to be loving and unselfish, you will take the time and effort to get your garden producing the best fruit possible so you can offer something valuable to others. You will invest in learning all there is to know about the garden God has given you, from your physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual health to your education, talents, gifts, callings, finances, relationships, and more, and how to make it flourish. And as you share your life with others, you will be doing what you need to do to protect and sustain your garden's productivity so that your health and the health of your relationships are not threatened. Consumers. The more you respect the value of your own life by cultivating your garden, the more you will create an atmosphere of respect around you. When people see how you care for your garden and taste the good fruit of your life, their words and behavior should demonstrate that they recognize your value. If they don't recognize the value of your life and what you have to offer, then you know you cannot be in relationship with them. The only people you want to connect yourself with are those who respect the value of your life and their own lives. Only then will your relationships be based on mutual respect and shared fruitfulness. The people you need to be able to set boundaries with are the people who recognize the value of your life but want to relate to you as a consumer. They are attracted to you and the good things that you have to offer, but they are not offering much from their own garden to you. These people may be good people who act polite and ask for things nicely. They may be people you find attractive and want to impress so much that you feel tempted to offer yourself up for their consumption. Or they may be aggressive, selfish users who use intimidation and manipulation to bleed you. You need a plan for dealing with all kinds of consumers who come into your garden. As my grandchildren were growing up, we liked to watch the movie Finding Nemo. It is the story of a clownfish named Marlin who goes on a journey to find his son, Nemo, in the oceans off the shores of Australia. In one of the scenes, Marlin and his companion Dory wind up near the ship's docks. Hundreds of seagulls are flying around saying, "Moin, moin, moin," as they pecked at the food, the fish, and each other. Each seagull is completely unaware of the fact that every other seagull is saying the same thing. They are each taking whatever they can get in small pieces. Seagull consumers are challenging to deal with because they are only asking for a little peck at a time. It's easy to let people like this get close to us and give them the benefit of the doubt as they peck at our resources. "Oh, you just need a few minutes. Okay. A few dollars. Okay. A meal. Okay." It all seems harmless until you realize, "Man, I just spent 6 hours today handling all these little requests. Did I really give away $100 this week?" You get a bunch of these seagulls all pecking little pieces away from your life, and before you know it, your garden will look like a pumpkin patch in November. It can be difficult to set boundaries with these types of consumers because each one of them may only be doing minimal damage. But if you want to preserve the health of your garden, you absolutely must set limits for how many people you allow to get near enough to you to take pecks and how many pecks you allow them to take. There's a learning process involved in identifying the types of consumers that want a piece of your life and the kind of boundaries you will need to set with them. When we lived in Weaverville, everyone had 8-foot chain link fences around their garden to keep out the deer. If bunnies are your problem, then you probably only need a few feet of chicken wire. Whatever the necessary boundary, its purpose is to protect the value of what's inside the garden and keep consumers out. The beautiful thing is that when you have the necessary boundary in place, you don't need to treat consumers like the enemy. If your garden has a fence, you can choose to throw some fruit over for the deer or offer a carrot to the bunny. When you have healthy boundaries, you stay in control of the resources of your life and manage them toward your priorities. The trap of bitterness. If you cannot set boundaries with consumers, you're going to be exploited. Being exploited is not pretty. We have all had different experiences with being taken advantage of by consumers. But what really matters is how we respond to these experiences. Will we forgive the offense and become powerful people who can protect and share our resources more effectively? Or will we agree with the disrespect that was shown us, take on a victim mentality, and allow people to continue to devalue our lives until we are fully exploited? People commonly end up fully exploited by becoming offended, bitter, and resentful toward consumers. Many wounded, traumatized people fall into this trap. The seagulls have pecked them to the bone, and they are hurting. Or maybe a friend has been very needy for a long time, and you feel absolutely sucked dry after being the only one pouring into the relationship. One way or another, healthy boundaries were not set. And instead of taking responsibility for this and setting a boundary, you blame the seagulls and the friend for his problems and become bitter. If you are bitter towards someone, every encounter with that person will jar that place of wounding and offense, agitating your pain. He or she may do the very same things that other people in your life are doing, but for some reason, when he or she does it, it feels like battery acid being thrown in your eyes. Eventually, you will explode in anger. One day, you'll go to the beach with a shotgun and kill as many seagulls as you can, or you will blow up at your friend, tell her how horrible he or she is, and yell, "Here's a boundary, stay away from me." Trust me, this is not a good way to set limits. After choosing bitterness, you will still be wounded, and on top of that, you will have destroyed relationships and will still have absolutely no guarantee that you will not be exploited again. The vicious merry-go-round will go around and around until you get so bitter that you turn your love off completely. Setting limits in close relationships. What happens when we wind up with a coworker, family member, spouse, or best friend who decides to start acting like a consumer? As we saw in the last chapter, these people get to demand more from us because of the access we have given them. They are in the inner circles of intimacy. If they start pulling on the connection to meet their needs, and we don't ever pull back by setting a boundary or asking them to meet our needs in return, then we are going to be dragging on the ground pretty quickly. The fruitfulness of our garden can diminish at an alarming rate if we do not know how to set boundaries with our close relationships. You know what? Jesus set boundaries with his best friends. One of my favorite examples of this is when Jesus explained to the disciples that he was going to suffer trial, condemnation, and the cross, and then be raised from the dead. Peter initially responds, "You can't go to the cross. We've got a good thing going here. This has been 3 years of awesomeness." Jesus spins around on his heel and says, "Get behind me, Satan." Whoa, Jesus called Peter Satan? Why? Because in that moment, he was talking to Satan, the one who ultimately opposed his destiny. "You are not in agreement with God on this one, Peter," he went on to explain. "You are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." Jesus had to set a limit with Peter because he was threatening Jesus' first priority to do his Father's will. Obviously, Peter was not intentionally trying to get Jesus to disobey God, but this story illustrates a danger we all must face. The closer a relationship is to your God spot, the greater the chance that the relationship could compete with him as your top priority. It all depends on whether or not you decide to listen to the fear of man. If the needs and wishes of your spouse, kids, or best friend start to gain a greater hold on your heart's affections and begin to define your priorities and choices, then you betray your allegiance to God. When you do this, you're actually aligning with Satan, just as Peter did, by elevating the things of men above the things of God. His priorities alone must define your life and choices, not the needs and choices of people. even people you care about most. Similarly, you must be careful about demanding or letting others put you in their God spot and take over defining their priorities and boundaries. You can encourage, invite, support, and enjoy others as they take responsibility to cultivate their gardens and value the life God has given them, but you must never take over that responsibility. Respecting the line between your life and the lives of others communicates love to them. You are saying, you get to be a whole person in this relationship. People who take responsibility for other people's lives and try to become their personal trunk monkeys are not loving. They are selfishly consuming another person's life and preventing them from becoming a powerful, responsible, whole person in the relationship. This is what codependency looks like. Parents with children who have drug and alcohol problems most often fall into this trap. Refusing to confront and hold their children accountable, they live in a state of denial as to why these things are happening, and in turn, they enable the addict to continue a destructive life. Codependency is driven by the agreement that I will work harder on your problem and your life than you do. That is not love. It can be one of the most difficult things in the world to set a boundary with someone in your inner circle who is breaking your heart with their choices. But if you want to protect your relationship with that person, you must be powerful enough to hold up your commitment to pursue the standard of respect in your interactions. If the person is consuming too much of your garden for you to stay healthy, you will also need to limit the access the person has to your life while still keeping your love on. If my son or daughter has a drug addiction or some other out-of-control lifestyle, I am responsible for setting up boundaries so they do not consume my time, energy, and resources beyond a healthy level. Before they lost control, I could trust them to take anything from my fridge. But now, they may decide to take my TV and computer so they can buy drugs. If necessary, I will change the locks on the house and inform them that I will call the police if they stop by when I am not there. I still love them, but I have to set up a necessary boundary to protect the rest of my family, myself, and ultimately my relationship with them. What are you going to do? As the saying goes, the best defense is a good offense. You're simply not going to be successful at setting boundaries if most of your time is spent defending yourself against the requests and demands of consumers. A good plan of offense is making sure your focus is fixed on cultivating the resources of your garden and directing the bulk of those resources toward mutually beneficial, healthy relationships. In order to carry out this offensive strategy, you need to get really good at telling yourself and others what you are going to do. I'm going to spend time with the Lord right now. I've committed that evening to my wife. I'm taking my kids on a hike that day. Saturdays are my day to read and study. These are all statements that set boundaries and tell people, this is where I'm pointing my resources. I love you, but I can't give you what you're asking from me at this moment because I have other priorities. As a powerful person, you'll always want to be focused on what you have the power to control, yourself. You also want your choices to be defined by the priorities you have committed yourself to, not by the choices of other people. When you tell someone what you're going to do, ask yourself, am I making this choice to protect my priorities? Am I making sure that I'm only telling this person what I will do and not telling them what they need to do? Will I honestly be okay no matter what he does? It's important to be able to answer yes to these questions if you want to maintain a successful offense in keeping your boundaries. I get to practice telling people what I'm going to do all the time. Everything from crisis situations to mild requests land in my voicemail on a regular basis, and I get to be powerful as I respond to them. For example, a while back, I got a call from a guy at church. Pastor, it's George. My wife left me last night. She told me in a note on the fridge. I think it's serious this time. I need to see you right away. Clearly, George was coming to me with a need he thought I could meet, a need he felt was very urgent. However, the needs of others do not control my choices, my priorities do. As it happens, one of my priorities is helping people who are going through relational crisis, so I knew I wanted to help George with this need, but I also had to balance that priority with my other priorities. I had already told my son that I would play basketball with him the evening that George called me. The next day was our family day. Family always takes precedence over ministry in my life. So I made a choice. I would wait till I could look at my calendar in 2 days, see what I had open for George, and call him back. 2 days later, calendar ready, I made the call. Hey there, George. I'm calling you back. How are you doing? Good Lord, came the distressed voice on the other end. Were you sick or in the hospital? You took 2 days to call me back. No, George. Actually, I was playing basketball with my son. The game went long, and then I needed to spend time with my family. What can I do for you? I don't know, but I need to get in to see you. I have to see you. Can I come in right now? Well, you can come in anytime you want. I'll be glad to meet with you on the 19th of this month. The 19th? That'll be 2 weeks away. I know. But you're a pastor. I have to see you right now. I just need 5 minutes. I'll have an hour on the 19th. That is what I'll do for you. But the note said that she won't come back until I see you. Probably so. I'll let you finish this conversation with my assistant who can set up that meeting for you on the 19th. Bye. I never told George what he could or could not do. I told him what I would do, without making excuses, apologies, or any attempts to convince him that my choice was right. I didn't need him to like the choice or agree with it. I didn't care if he was offended by it. I simply laid my offer on the table and left him to consider it. This is what it looks like to let powerful choices communicate boundaries to people. The ability to say no. In order to be consistent in telling ourselves what to do, we need to be able to do two other things. First, we need to be able to follow through on what we say we will do. And second, we need to be able to say what we will not do. Every yes needs to be backed up with action and a clear no to everything else. As we saw in the last chapter, Jesus was able to say no when he needed to. Another amazing account highlighting Jesus' power to choose is found in Mark. In this passage, Jesus sends the disciples across the Sea of Galilee into a windstorm while he spends time with his Father. Then in the middle of the night, Jesus sees the disciples in a boat rowing away, desperately fighting the wind. He starts walking across the sea and easily catches up to the boat. Inexplicably, the Bible says he would have passed them by. What is that about? Jesus' buddies are struggling in the boat and he's going to pass them by? Why would he do that? Well, it is one of his options. He didn't have to go to them. He did go to them after they cried out to him, but this verse makes it clear that Jesus had a choice. He could have said no to the disciples. He was able to say yes because he was also capable of saying no. So many people say yes to things they really want to say no to, which makes their choices powerless and not powerful. This can easily happen when people don't wait to find out what they're choosing when they choose it. These situations may go something like this. Hey, Danny, you want to help me move? Sure. Yeah, I can do that. Tomorrow? My son has a baseball game in the morning. No problem. How about 6 a.m.? You busy then? It's my day off, so I wasn't planning on getting up that early, but sure. Can we borrow your truck? We don't have one. Yeah, sure. Great. Can you fill it up with gas? Because I don't have any money either. Okay. You can just feel the anxiety of a trapped victim growing as this conversation progresses. If we want to make powerful choices, then we need to find out just what we are choosing. We also need to know that we can say no as well as yes. See how the conversation goes when we do that? Hey, Danny, want to help me move? I can't. I'm practicing boundaries today. Why? So that when I do help everybody else this week, I know that I can say no. When you start telling people what you're going to do and what you're not going to do and follow through on both, people come to believe what you say. Your words have weight. The first time you turn around and walk out of a disrespectful conversation, you will probably surprise and maybe even offend the other person. But it will also set a standard for being in a relationship with you. If the person you walked out on wants to keep you in the room during the next conversation, then he will manage himself to honor your standard. I know a woman who decided she would no longer contribute to any disrespectful conversation ever again. The next time she and her husband had a disagreement that led into rage and intimidation, she stopped and announced, "I'll be glad to finish this conversation when it becomes respectful. I can see you're upset. As long as it stays respectful, I'll stay." He continued to explode. She walked out. He was stunned at first, then angry. He felt powerless and punished. He sat and fumed in anger. His wife waited a full hour before she returned to the room. She had remained calm and self-controlled, because she had a genuine desire to resolve the conflict. She came and asked him if he wanted to have the conversation again. After seeing his wife consistently behave the same way in their various disagreements, this husband became convinced that she was really never going to participate in a disrespectful conversation. He also had to believe that if she could control herself, so could he. If at any time she said, "I'll be happy to have this conversation if it stays respectful," he started to adjust his tone and choice of words so he could keep her in the room while they worked out the conflict. This couple now has a new standard for conversation when they have a conflict, a standard they both prefer. Good communication and healthy boundaries gave these two adults what they needed to stay powerful and maintain their connection. They have more trust, honor, and love for one another. Their conflicts are resolved in a way where they both feel safe, but only because they are willing to change. The more others encounter us honoring the boundaries we have set for our lives, the more they will know they can trust us with their lives. Setting and honoring boundaries is essential to creating a relational culture of respect, honor, trust, and love in our connections with people. Chapter 10. Did you learn to love? Love is changing my city, Redding, California. Each week, members of the church where I am on staff and students of the ministry school go out and bless Redding with prayer and practical ministry for the homeless and addicts on the street, people living in halfway homes, jail inmates, and poverty-stricken families. They pick up trash, pull weeds, and scrub away graffiti. If there's a need in the city, our students can't wait to volunteer to fill it. Our leaders are also actively involved in pursuing our community leaders so we can build connection with them and learn where we can best strengthen the health of our city. Redding used to be a little wary of our church's outreaches, but they have come to receive them and gratefully acknowledge the benefits we are offering. Instead of trying to get people to come to our meeting and conform to us, we are going out into the community and blessing it. We are turning our love on and asking our city, "What do you need?" We are building trust by meeting those needs. Our goal is not to create distance with the world, but to remove disconnection and fear wherever we find it. We are responding with love to the brokenness we encounter in people's lives and inviting them to become healthy, powerful, and free along with us. And people are responding. They feel loved. Trust, honor, respect, cooperation, and connection are beginning to flourish in the relationships with our community. The sin problem. Many of the church's evangelistic efforts have been directed towards getting people into a building where they can be cleaned up and reformed out of their sinful lifestyles. Unfortunately, the methods used for this cleanup process are nothing more than old rattlesnake tools of religion, fear, control, and punishment. Once people get saved, they find out that despite what they've heard about the cross, everyone in church is still freaked out by sin. It's hard to go out and love sinners like Jesus did when we're still afraid of our own sin. This is why many churches are failing to make a significant impact on their cities. The church simply must get deeply in touch with what the gospel actually means in regard to how we are now to relate to God and man. Jesus invited people into a connection with him, not a religious reform program. He showed up in the midst of our brokenness with compassion and healing, shocking everyone by how fearless he was in keeping his love on with sinners. Jesus didn't create distance with broken people. He created connection. But this shouldn't surprise us, because we know that his entire mission was to finally remove sin, the source of all relational disconnection, through the cross. 1 John 2:1-2 states, "When he served as a sacrifice for our sin, Jesus solved the sin problem for good, not ours only, but the whole world's." Other translations use the word propitiation. He himself is the propitiation for our sins. Propitiation is a completely satisfying sacrifice that closes the gap between God and his children. Only Jesus Christ could serve as a sacrifice, and he did. He solved the problem of sin. He solved it for everyone, for good. It doesn't matter who has or who has not prayed the prayer. Sin has been handled, and everyone has access to the Father. For some reason, so many Christians believe that people can only be forgiven at the beginning of their relationship with God. "It doesn't matter what you did," we tell new converts, "because you were washed by the blood. You were once Scarlett O'Hara, and now you are Snow White. You are clean." And so they come in, grateful to be accepted. But soon they discover that this acceptance isn't unconditional by any stretch of the imagination. Instead, what they hear is, okay, now that you're in here, now that you're clean, you can never make a mess again. We are keeping track. This is a holy place. There is no sin in here. If you happen to burst the bubble of delusion by making a mess, you are then punished, usually by people turning their love off and disconnecting from you. Or your home group leader or pastor or some random church lady will tell you to knock it off and get your act together so the image of spotless can be maintained for the public. You quickly learn that if you want to preserve relationship in the church, then you cannot show people the truth of who you are. You must submit to control by hiding, performing, and agreeing. Church leaders have to pretend they don't ever sin. If you ever expect to move up the ladder of church leadership, then you have to become pretty fabulous at keeping secrets. This next level here, this is where we put you in charge of stuff. Now, this one right here is when you have a toilet in your house, but you have to act like you never use it. And people at this level here, well, they don't use a toilet. Finally, this level would be senior leadership. That's when they actually come to your house and remove the toilet. Maintaining the illusion that no sin exists at the top of the ladder creates a ridiculous gap between regular people who sin and leaders who supposedly do not. It turns leaders into liars because they are not allowed to be real people anymore. This only sets them up for isolation and a fall. I'm in the people business and I know people. There are people on the ground level and there are people 10 stories up. I am a person. Ask my wife. She will confirm with a resounding yes. Being in the people business and being afraid of sin is like being a rancher and being afraid of manure. Imagine a rancher saying, oh yeah, we taught the cows to walk around with their tails tucked up between their legs. We have officially created a manure-free farm right here, and our cows are permanently clean. Trust me, manure-free cows go against nature, and eventually one of them will, well, kaboom. This is what happens in the church. We create a false expectation based on illusion because we are afraid of people's mistakes. Then our leaders occasionally go kaboom and get their mess all over everything. But we never say, oh yeah, now I get it. You're a person too. Welcome to the ranch. We say in horror and shock, see, that's why we are afraid of people right there. Now everyone is hurt and smelly. Have you ever read the Bible? Believe it or not, it is full of stories about people who've made big messes. There's stuff in there you definitely don't want your children to read. But unlike us, God never once pretended that these messmakers weren't going to blow it. We imagine that God was surprised and disappointed when Adam and Eve ate the fruit. Really? I can't believe you guys did this. How could you? How could you make such a big mess? Now everything is ruined. But we are mistaken. God knew exactly what he was getting into when he went into the people business. He has never been afraid of manure. In fact, he has the most blindingly brilliant plan for dealing with manure. The cross separates us from our mess every time, no matter how big. Love, love, love. By solving the sin problem, Jesus created a safe place, the safest place in the world, for us to be loved, known, accepted, and forgiven. He has given us one big requirement if we want to live and flourish in this safe place of relationship with him. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. If we're not obeying Christ's command to love one another, then we simply don't know him or have much of a relationship with him at all. As John wrote, my dear children, let's not just talk about love, let's practice real love. This is the only way we'll know we're living truly, living in God's reality. A lot of people think that if they're using their spiritual gifts, they must have a relationship with God. But gifts can be used outside of a connection. Gifts can be used without love. The sign that you're in a relationship with Jesus is that you love people, period. I've crossed paths with so many people who say they have an amazing relationship with Jesus, but in reality, all they have are some amazing gifts from Jesus. And I know this by looking at how they love. They dance with flags, paint prophetic pictures, and pray all the time in their prayer caves, but they don't know how to open their heart to another person and build an intimate connection. They don't know how to know or be known. They've retreated from relationships, thinking that they can be spiritual without them. Unfortunately, this won't work. Our spiritual calling is nothing less than to love and be loved by God and people. Our spiritual training and growth can only occur in the context of relationship. The whole nature of a relationship is that you cannot control it. All you can control is your free choice to love others and receive love. When you make this choice, freedom grows and fear goes. The sign that you really have love in your relationships is that you and the people around you are free and are not scared. Free people are going to tell you the truth. They are going to make mistakes. That will test the relationship and the state of your heart. It will require you to grow up and become powerful. But the more powerful you become, the more you'll be able to hold on to your connection with people and help them as they work through their truth and clean up their mess, just like Jesus does. So, did you? I once heard a man tell his story about being struck by lightning, twice. He actually died, and believe it or not, ended up in heaven talking to God. God didn't ask him, "Did you give all your money to the poor, or did you raise the dead?" Instead, he asked, "Did you learn to love?" The man said no. Then God gave him another shot at life. I think we should pay close attention to the question, "Did you learn to love?" This is the question. This is the only thing you are responsible for. This is the only thing that God cannot work out for you. No matter what miraculous things God is doing around you and through you, you must never lose sight of this priority. All the signs, wonders, gifts, and supernatural events in the world do not prove that you are connected heart to heart with God. Jesus warned about the last days when people would come to him and ask, "Didn't I prophesy the paint off the wall? Didn't I do amazing things in your name?" And hear him say, "I never knew you." Do you want Jesus to know you? Do you want to know him? Then love him and love others. The Bible couldn't be more clear about this. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love God does not know God, for God is love. People who really know God can do shocking things. They can do powerful things. They can love people that many people would declare unforgivable and impossible to love. A woman recently told me, "Danny, I wanted to thank you. 2 years ago, you took the time out of your day to call me while you were at the airport between flights. My nephew raped my daughter. I was about to go into court when we talked. You said that I needed to keep my heart open to my nephew and to keep my love on. You also said that my daughter would follow our lead of forgiveness and reconciliation. I had already listened to a message you had given about keeping your love on, and my heart wanted to love, but my mommy claws were about to come out. You gave me the clarity I needed to be okay, and I chose the right way to protect my daughter's heart. That event could have destroyed my family forever, but we chose to love. We created boundaries and loved with our whole hearts. There were lots of God moments throughout the trial, and they continued to come afterward. We have had a family gathering since then, and I look at him now without hating him in my heart. We are not afraid because we chose to love. The fear never took hold. I am now addicted to this full, open heart of love. It has made me know how safe and powerful I truly am. And our daughter has followed our lead. She has forgiven him and loves well. She is not forgotten, but she truly loves." When Jesus asked this woman if she learned to love, she'll be able to answer, yes. What about you? How are you answering this question right now in your relationship with God and others? Love that can go to hell and back. One of the most important opportunities to answer this question in our family came through our relationship with Sherry's older brother, Ted. Ted struggled for a long time and made messes everywhere. Drugs were a huge part of his life. Heroin, meth, you name it. Everywhere Ted went was a disaster zone. Ted's girlfriend gave birth to his son while she was in prison. At that time, Ted was living with us, and he and Sherry flew down to Southern California to pick up his newborn baby. Ted began raising his son in our home and walking with the Lord. We fell in love with this little boy. Sadly, a few years later, within months of his girlfriend getting out of prison, Ted went back into the drug scene. Sherry and I visited him on occasion in his ramshackle drug home and tried to talk to him. He had no electricity and no running water. The carpet was burnt from candles falling over and starting fires while everyone was passed out. Ted's son, then 4 years old, would often run unsupervised up and down the street in their rotten neighborhood. During one visit with Ted, who looked worse than he ever had, his son brought his car seat out of the house and put it in our car. but we couldn't take him with us. He was not our son. It was absolutely heartbreaking. Much later, Ted told us he remembered that day, and he saw there had been a spiritual battle going on. "It was like you were an angel trying to rescue me," he said, "but I was in so much darkness, I didn't want anything to do with you." A few weeks after that visit, the authorities arrested Ted, and his son went into foster care. He was absolutely out of control. We had to do something. We became foster parents and took our nephew home. At that time, I had been a foster care social worker for several years, but I had never seen anything like my nephew. He manifested demons every day. On one occasion, he turned to Sherry, who was holding on to him, and said, "I'm going to cut your head off and spit down your neck." We did numerous deliverances on this little boy over the course of a year. Gradually, he calmed down and began to behave normally. Wonderfully, Ted eventually reconnected with Jesus and got healed. He was able to get his little boy and life back. Every year, Ted gets a sobriety coin from Narcotics Anonymous. Recently, Ted came over and handed Sherry his 10-year coin from NA. He says that no one has ever loved him like she loved him. "My wife's relationship with her brother has been filled with craziness. I can't think of anybody who has been as challenging to keep close to the family as Uncle Ted during those tough times. We watched him go to hell and back, and we kept our love on the whole time. Now, Uncle Ted would take a bullet for us, and his son is doing just fine. In fact, he is doing wonderfully." Bigger Hearts. David wrote, "I will run the course of your commandments, for you shall enlarge my heart." If we're going to keep the one big commandment he gave us, to love as he loves, then we need bigger hearts. If we'll let him, I think God will make us like Secretariat, that freakishly fast champion racehorse who blew contenders away with his shocking, unprecedented stamina. After his death, veterinarians discovered the secret to this horse's incredible power. Secretariat had a heart nearly 3 times the size of an average horse's heart, an estimated 22 pounds. Just imagine what would happen if a bunch of Christians started walking around with hearts 3 times as powerful and loving as anyone else around them. People might actually start believing that God is real. It's time for the world to see a church who can keep her love on. It's time for the sons and daughters of God to mature into a company of powerful people who know how to walk in freedom, practice intimacy and vulnerability, clean up our messes, and invite people around us to become powerful, free lovers. It's time for those who bear the name of Jesus to become famous for carrying his huge heart, that absolutely fearless heart of love that pursues connection with broken sinners. This is how the world will know we know him. So ask God to give you a 22-pound heart, his heart. Then turn your love on and keep your love on no matter what. I'll leave you with this declaration to make over your relationships. I know the spirit of power and love are at work in me. I can love at all times through Christ who strengthens me. I am courageous with my love. I am powerful to control myself no matter what others choose to believe or do. My goal is connection, not distance. I will tell others about me and let them tell me about them. I matter, and so do you. I clearly and honestly express what I am feeling and what I need to feel. I listen well to what others are feeling and what they need to feel. I communicate my value and priorities by expecting respect. I show respect by listening well and honoring the boundaries of others. I keep my love on and chase fear out of my most vital relationships. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for listening to Keep Your Love On. The end.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.